Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Pentagon's acting inspector general tells Congress budget shortfalls are to blame for delays in investigating whistleblower reprisal claims. As Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu reports, the investigations took an average of about 300 days last year, much longer than the guidelines allow in federal law.
The 300-day figure is an improvement from the year before, when it took 526 days for the IG to process an average reprisal complaint. But it's still far beyond the 180 days Congress had in mind when it established the rules for investigating whistleblower cases. Whistleblower advocates and the Government Accountability Office say speed is important. Not only can memories fade, affecting witness testimony, but long delays can leave employees that have valid complaints in hostile work environments. On the other hand, unfounded complaints can leave innocent people's careers in limbo while they're under investigation. Glenn Fine, the acting DOD IG, says his office has beefed up its whistleblower reprisal investigations unit from a staff of 28 in 2010 to 54 as of this year by reshuffling some funds internally. But the IG's overall budget has been flat and unable to keep up with the growth of the DOD workforce, which has led to a natural growth in whistleblower claims. There were 284 reprisal complaints in 2005. The IG expects to get 1,600 this year.
You know, there is a burgeoning caseload in whistleblower. It is dramatically increased. We have not dramatically increased our resources. We are doing more with less. If I believe as an IG, we ought to be commensurate with the Department of Defense. If they grow, we ought to grow. If they're stable, we ought to be stable. If they're constricted, we ought to constrict. If you look at the last 20 years, the Department of Defense has grown dramatically. We haven't. If we had simply kept pace with them, we would have 500 more employees. We would be able to do these with more resources rather than giving our investigators lots and lots of cases to work on. And I think that would inure to everybody's benefit.
Fine's comments came in the context of a House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing in which the IG's office was under fire at various different times for chasing cases either too zealously or sweeping too many of them under the rug. In the latter category, members and outside watchdog groups are concerned about the extremely low number of whistleblower reprisal complaints the DOD IG manages to substantiate. Its latest semi-annual report to Congress shows the office closed 350 complaints in the first half of 2016 and confirmed only one case of reprisal, and it dismissed 305 of those cases without investigating them. Going back further, according to statistics compiled by the Project on Government Oversight, the IG dismissed 86% of its military whistleblower cases without full investigations. Mandy Smithberger is the director of POGO's Strauss Military Reform Project.
We were surprised that this rate was more than double that for the service IGs, who are traditionally considered to be less independent. DOD IG substantiated only 1% of the cases during this period. Frankly, things are bad for most whistleblowers who come to DOD IG. DOD IG substantiated only 7 out of over 1,300 complaints received from civilians and contractors. Those rates are about half of what we have seen for federal employee whistleblowers at the Office of Special Counsel. Low investigation and low substantiation rates create the appearance the office is focused on closing rather than investigating the cases it receives. We get concerned when we see substantiation rates that are as low as 1% or less than 1%, because that seems to send the message that there aren't really any credible whistleblowers that have been reprised against. And we see that those numbers are much lower than we've seen for OSC. One of the great things that DOD IG does is that they do report what happens to all of these cases. We wish that all of the IGs would do so that we could ask the same kinds of questions, and we really appreciate their transparency on this.
Fine disputed POGO's conclusions, though, saying the IG did not actually dismiss 86% of its cases. Some of them, he says, were referred to the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force IGs. But he did not mount a defense of the DOD IG's low rate of substantiated cases.
Our job is to take the facts wherever they lead. And if it's substantiated in our view, we should do that. And if it's not, we shouldn't. And we are going to get criticized from both sides. You're too hard. You're too soft. You're doing a whitewash. You're doing a witch hunt. You're a junkyard dog. You're a lap dog. You get that often in the same case. We can't let that deter us. We have to look at the evidence and look at the facts. And we take each case on its merits, and we try and follow them through. It is a challenging task. It is a challenging task to determine if there really was retaliation or whether it was an unfair allegation of reprisal. And we look for the evidence, and we take it where it leads. That's our job, and that's what I try to describe how we're trying to improve our processes.
On the witch hunt side of the ledger, lawmakers invoked the case of Rear Admiral Brian Losey, accused of retaliating against whistleblowers while he was the commander of Special Operations Forces in Africa. Losey later rose to become the top commander of Navy SEALs, despite a DOD IG investigation that dragged on for nearly 5 years. Although the Navy disagreed with the IG's conclusions, senators in the bipartisan Whistleblowers Caucus accused Losey of being a serial retaliator and successfully blocked his promotion to two-star admiral, effectively ending his career. Montana Congressman Ryan Zinke is a former SEAL commander who worked closely with Losey. He says the investigation was highly problematic, and so was the pressure the Senate put on the Navy to force him out.
Over the course of five investigations of acts of reprisal by Rear Admiral Losey, the DOD IG was blatant violation of military law and Uniform Code of Military Justice. Title 10, U.S. Section Code 1034, clearly states the DOD IG is required to complete their investigations in 180 days or less. Unfortunately, four out of five investigations completed by the DOD IG were in complete disregard for the 180 deadline.
That's not strictly true. The 180-day figure only obliges the IG to let commanders and the complainant know that investigation is underway and that it won't be finished within that time frame. But until recently, the DOD IG hadn't even been doing that. Fine says that's now changed because of upgrades to the IG's computerized case management system that will now alert its staff when a case is approaching the 180-day threshold. That change came about after the Government Accountability Office flagged major problems in the DOD IG's practices for response to whistleblower complaints in separate reports in 2012 and 2015. Among other problems, GAO pointed out that DOD and the military services have different terminologies and procedures surrounding different stages of whistleblower reprisal investigations, leading to confusion about whether a case was actually investigated by the time the records made their way into DOD's case management system. Fine says his office has already resolved 15 of the 18 recommendations GAO made in its prior reports, but aside from standardizing processes between the DOD IG and the military components, GAO says the IG's office still needs to find a way to track whether defense components have taken corrective action on the complaints that it has substantiated. Separately, the Project on Government Oversight says it's received numerous complaints from inside the DOD IG's office that would seem to question that office's role as an independent watchdog, including that Henry Shelley, the IG's general counsel, illegally destroyed files in a whistleblower reprisal case under investigation by the Office of Special Counsel. Again, POGO's Mandy Smithberger.
This is only the latest of various allegations that have come to public attention, that Mr. Fine's top legal advisor engages in a systemic practice of improperly interfering with and undermining personnel investigations. For example, a POGO investigation found that as a top legal advisor to one of Mr. Fine's predecessors, Mr. Shelley helped direct a process that permanently suppressed the findings of a team of IG investigators regarding top officials of the Department of Defense, including the Secretary of Defense.
Fine says his office decided on its own to ask the Justice Department Inspector General to investigate those allegations, even though Shelley adamantly disputes them.
Adamantly. Came to me, and instead of sweeping it on the rug, I decided, you know what, let's get an outside investigation, an independent investigation of this, and we'll take it wherever it leads and we'll address it. And I think it's unfair to think that he's guilty before it's done, but it's also important to investigate it, and that's what we do, and it is difficult, but that's what you have to do, and that's what we did in this case.
Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Share the story with colleagues. Go to FederalNewsRadio.com/FederalDrive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department has a Byzantine process that's meant to ensure it only acquires what it really needs. But there's no comparable set of guardrails to make sure it doesn't get rid of things it does need. That's one conclusion of auditors at the Government Accountability Office. They fault the Air Force for not doing enough homework before it proposed to get rid of the A-10 fighter. John Pendleton is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at GAO. He tells Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu the Air Force didn't adequately account for all the missions the A-10 performs before it decided to ground it.
That really is the most important question here. There will be a bit of a lag there, assuming the F-35 comes on. But everyone, let's talk a little bit about what the A-10 is and what all it does. I mean, it's iconic, right? It's a flying tank. It has the Gatling gun in the front. It's beloved by the many ground troops that it's supported in combat. And everyone knows it for the close air support that it does. But with precision-guided munitions and unmanned systems, we can drop bombs from bombers now and support ground troops and from UASs, and we got different ways to perform CAS, and that's what everyone is focused on, but the A-10 does more, and the CAS community that supports it does more, like combat search and rescue. When a pilot is down, the A-10 pilots and the aircraft are the ones that typically coordinate the rescue mission, and they provide cover for the rescue helicopters that would come in, and it's not clear how the Air Force will perform this mission even after they get the F-35. And then there's the issue of the fact that the CAS pilots focus on these missions, right? That, I mean, compared to an F-16 pilot or an F-35 pilot, an A-10 pilot does 22 close air support sorties in a year to be qualified, where an F-16 pilot does maybe 12 because they're training lots of other missions. So the idea that the multi-role fighters will fill in all the gaps, I'm just not sure that's right.
Yeah, and I want to talk about specific capabilities a little bit more in a minute, but I think more fundamentally, no one knows the full extent of the capability gaps because the Air Force doesn't really have a process for coming up with a baseline for what its overall fighter requirements are. Is that fair?
No, that really is an issue. It was an issue for us here because, you know, GAO likes its criteria. We don't want to just make up things. We want to look and see what the rules are, and requirements very often set the foundation for a program, and we really found that the Air Force doesn't have clearly stated capacity requirements for close air support or the other missions that the A-10 does. It sounds like a simple question, how much do you need, but apparently it's not a simple answer, and the lack of such requirements makes it really difficult to evaluate the impact of any shortfall.
And not just requirements for close air support, but requirements or any kind of process for evaluating requirements in light of any kind of divestment decision.
Well, how are you
right?
going to mitigate the impact
right.
is the main question, right?
Right.
I mean, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And what we were hoping to see is detailed analysis about how you would do CSAR Sandy or Forward Air Control Airborne, which is another mission that the department does, or the fast attack, against swarm boats. And we just didn't see the detailed analysis that we were hoping for, even on the classified side.
And it seems like one of the issues that you guys were getting at is some of those secondary missions have been maybe even being neglected in the training environment because there's been such a focus on the close air support capabilities of the A-10.
I think that that is possibly true, but we were more concerned that it wasn't clear to us how we would do some of the things even after we got the F-35 in. The Air Force has stood up some integration groups and things to study that, which I think is sort of a tacit acceptance that some work needs to be done, which is a step in the right direction. But it just wasn't clear to us how they were going to meet these other missions.
How much does the decision to push the A-10 retirement proposal a little further into the out years mitigate some of these capability gaps to the extent that we understand the capability gaps?
Oh, I think it, again, we couldn't do that analysis because you don't have the requirements to give you a precise answer,
mm-hmm.
but the A-10 is the best at many of these things. I mean, it just absolutely is, and A-10 pilots are the ones that really focus on this, the doctors of CAS, they've been called. And by CAS, they mean the things like combat search and rescue, SANDY. It's a catch-all term that means all the things that these A-10 pilots and squadrons do.
Getting back to one of the issues that you mentioned before, just the topic of the Air Force simply not having a good methodology for thinking about requirements that are going to go unfilled if it decides to divest something. How big a problem is that? To what extent is that a DOD-wide problem, I guess, is my question.
I think that really is the heart of the issue. If you step back from just the A-10, I mean, the department has a lot of aging things, and there's going to be more and more decision points where they have to decide at what point to let go of the old stuff to make room for the newer, more capable stuff. And especially if you're still using the old stuff a lot. You know, like I said, we like our criteria at GAO, and we had a problem from the get-go here on this because there's no specific rules for divesting multi-million-dollar platforms. I mean, everyone's aware that it takes several acts of Congress to buy something, to acquire something, and lots of laws and regulations. But the services, by contrast, can decide to divest something as part of a budget drill, which is what happened here. The Air Force didn't really want to let go of the A-10. They just didn't have enough money. They couldn't make it fit in the palm.
Sure.
And we saw something similar a couple of years back on with the Navy, when the Navy proposed to retire early some cruisers and dock landing ships. And that was another case where Congress stopped them because they just didn't feel like they'd adequately made their case. So we stepped back and we made a broader recommendation here that basically said, DOD, we think you ought to put some guidance out about, you know, the kinds of things you want to consider in these divestment proposals, because it made it difficult for us to evaluate, and it leaves the services a little bit vulnerable when people ask questions. I mean, it's an oversimplification, but, you know, we have acquisition rules so we don't buy things we don't need. Our argument is we need clear divestment rules so we don't get rid of stuff that we do need. And again, I'm not trying to describe a Byzantine process on the other side that equals the acquisition process, but not having any guidance, I'm not sure is acceptable either.
You mentioned that you noticed this with the Navy program a couple years ago, but as far as the absence of that process around divestment, is that something that GAO's been concerned about in a broader context before, or did this A-10 study really bring that to light?
Well, in my portfolio, you know, I look at force structure and readiness issues, not so much the acquisition side. And so when we got to this point, we started conferring with our folks that do acquisition and started looking at sort of where the department was with a lot of its systems. And again, this capacity, the notion that we need a lot of stuff now and that a lot of it is aging versus, you know, capability, buying new stuff. We started this is going to keep coming up. And so we thought it made sense for us to sort of put this mark in the ground and say, DOD, maybe you ought to think about setting some rules for this to keep from these things from getting sort of pushed back at you from the Congress. The department did not agree. They do not want to do that. They not concur with that recommendation.
Right. As you said earlier, this was a budget-driven decision. But as far as estimating the amount of money that you'd actually save by getting rid of the A-10, you also found the estimates the Air Force had been giving Congress weren't credible, or at least didn't meet best practices for being credible, if there's a meaningful difference between those things. Tell us why.
Yeah, I mean, I could go down that rabbit hole pretty far, but I'll save you from that. We have various aspects we look at in cost estimates, but what they did was pretty simple. They had a bunch of Air Force leaders together, and they looked at various missions, and they said, okay, we've been told to prioritize modernization, and let's look at the cost of all these various missions. And the A-10, you know, in a situation where you're prioritizing modernization, it's nearly 40 years old, many of them, it didn't fare real well. And so they said, well, how much can we save? And what the Air Force did was go into its program, the Future Years Defense Program, and say, how much is in there for the A-10? And that's fine for a broad brush sense of savings, but it left things out. You know, there are things you might have to do if you don't have the A-10 that weren't part of that cost estimate. And it could have overstated or understated how much you would save. So it doesn't give you the kind of fidelity that you need for, you know, to really identify how much you'd save. It's probably in the ballpark, but there'd be costs that probably were not contemplated, and there may be additional savings that weren't contemplated.
And obviously you can't take all of that money out of the FYDP, because one of the things that they've been arguing for is to take their existing A-10 maintainers and move them to the F-35. So that alone is probably a fairly big expense.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the Air Force has got an in-strength challenge as well. And they're short maintainers already. They'd already started making some of these changes. So sometimes the savings, as you know, in the government is actually a transfer. But the Air Force is quite short on maintainers. Absolutely.
Back to your recommendations. You mentioned earlier that one of the key ones had been kicked to the curb. Any you feel like you've made any headway in convincing either the Air Force or larger DOD about what needs to be done here?
You know, I think despite the Air Force not concurred with our contention that they needed more information should they bring back this proposal to divest the A-10 to really walk through some of the issues that I've described here. The Air Force responded that they felt they had done that, and that their analysis, and I'm quoting here because I think it's important for the listeners to hear this. The Air Force said the A-10 divestment was the most acceptable strategy to remain within Air Force budget authority
while controlling risk across all mission sets. And by all, they mean Air Force mission sets primarily. And that may very well be true for the Air Force, but that we're not sure that it was necessarily true for across the department. Now, having their non-concurrence notwithstanding, they're doing some things that we mention in the report. Again, they have an integration group. They're talking about how they would meet some of the gaps that are being identified. And but we just didn't have enough to go on yet about whether or not that, those would actually follow through. So despite their non-concurrence, they're actually doing some things that are steps in the right direction.
John Pendleton, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at GAO, speaking with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.